Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. I'm hoping I'm able to free some money. I mean, I know our disposable income is just increasing tenfold because of the geopolitical situation around the world, but I am hoping that people do realize that we're getting to a point where if we don't start getting champions for the cause of the Constitution and saving our government, then you know, I'd like to hear somebody else's plan of what we're going to do, or you know, and I think maybe that hate to say it, but that plan may be just sucking it up. And I know quite a few people that would probably rather go out, you know, die fighting instead of submitting to evil. But all that being said, Gerald Winstrom is running a campaign, and I would love to see my audience be able to send him $5 a month or something that helps, you know, with his transportation requirements and so forth. Because I had a conversation with him earlier this week, and he's not getting much contributions. So please, please help him out with this campaign. He actually has a shot, by the way, because the incumbent isn't running, and that's kind of their strategy in Missouri. And so we've had other people that we've ran, but they were not running Republican going into the primary. So Gerald is running Republican. He may switch beforehand, but anyway. And I don't know if they filed it. I think the filing comes up in May. So that's maybe when he'll actually have to force going into independent, into the general, or what have you. But folks, let's get a constitutionalist elected. With that, we've got Sean back with us. We've had an absence of Tammy because she's had some family issues to deal with. We all know what that's like. And boy, what a blessing it is having family in our lives. And so welcome back, Sean.
Glad to be here, sir. Thank you.
No, thank you. And folks, we are still plugging away on the Federalist Papers. We're going through because we're nitpicking these. And we want to nitpick these the first time through so that we can really highlight all of these things. So next time when we do this again, we will just be able to go straight into the highlights. If you want to get the rest of it, then you can tune in. As a matter of fact, there are audiobooks that will give you the Federalist Papers. No audiobooks that will give you many of these other documents other than this content on this show. So anyway, let's dive into, and I think what we were talking about, paragraph 20 of Federalist Paper number 81. By all means, go ahead.
This view of the matter, at any rate, puts it out of all doubt that the supposed abolition of trial by jury by the operation of this provision is fallacious and untrue. The legislature of the United States would certainly have full power to provide that in appeals to the Supreme Court there should be no reexamination of facts where they had been tried in the original causes by juries. This would certainly be an authorized exception, but if, for the reason already intimated, it should be thought too extensive, it might be qualified with a limitation to such causes only as are determinable at common law in that mode of trial.
Okay, so he's bringing up again, because the concept of a trial by jury is a common law concept. The concept of civil law in England is, I guess they had magistrates, I'm not sure, but in America, civil law was based in the Constitution. Now, let's be clear. Civil law is based in the Constitution, although those things arising under the Constitution. So in other words, it's not covered under the jurisdiction of common law. In your state, you have to read your state constitution to determine the jurisdictions delegated to your state court. If it grants common law, then all things falling under common law would be basically under the jurisdiction of the state court. I've yet to see any constitution that's done that. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't exist. There's 50 of them, and I haven't read 50. And I've only, out of the maybe 20 some I have, I've only really looked a few times because I've got a lot of other things to do. But I have looked specifically, probably about maybe 8 to 10 times in the different states. I know in Washington State, the state court does not have jurisdiction over common law issues. So what that means is that all things that are listed, enumerated in that constitution, is the jurisdiction of your state court. If it grants property, because property cases, you know, is a common law thing. It's just like contract law. Contract law is a common law thing. So if they've actually taken, like family, you know, the family law and so forth, that would be a common law thing. Criminal law would be civil law because it is the civil, you know, we create laws that say you can't drink on Sundays. Prostitution's illegal, blah, blah, blah. Those are tried as crimes, but they would still be in a common law state. They would still be criminal law, would still be under common law, where you would still have a right to a trial by jury. And I'm just trying to think of the cases, but you'd have to look at your constitution. And then when you're looking at your constitution, only those things, again, do they have jurisdiction. If they don't have jurisdiction over common law, then all things that, you know, that really pertain to we the people should be going into a common law court. And the reason why this is so important, we've kind of covered this a couple of times in the past few days. Common law courts are no longer in existence in America, as far as I know. I take that back. I've heard somebody proffer, I think the guy's name was Ed, proffer that there are common law courts in Texas. There may be, I think, I'm not sure if when I was talking to Paul in Georgia, whether they had common law courts or not, but he did talk about common law grand juries being stood up. So one might allude to, well, man, it sounds like they got common law courts. But as I look at all of the states in the union, I don't know of any really common law courts. I don't know of anybody going into a divorce that actually stands in front of a jury. So you've got a problem. You're not getting the justice that has been established for your state, unless you're in Louisiana, of course, but because they're running under civil law and they're doing a good job at it. Actually, they have implemented some common law court cases, like in capital cases, if I remember correctly. So, and Sean will probably correct me, which is fine. But for the most part, when we look at what you should be having, when you have a property dispute or what have you, you're not supposed to stand in front of a judge. You, especially if that property value is over $20. You know, dispute in the transferring of a title of your car, and your car value is a couple thousand dollars or what have you. Those types of things should be in front of trials by jury. The reason they got rid of it is, one, it's just too hard for them to control, and it costs too much money. That's because the way the courts have set it up. In a common law court, you don't need a lawyer. And when you actually look at a common law court, there's an administrator, and actually the National Liberty Alliance would give you really good, thorough background on the common law court, the petite court, the grand court, the petite jury, grand jury, and so forth. And all they're far smarter on this than I am. And so John Durash, and I forget, Gerald, I forget his last name. They're the two founders. They're still alive, and they're still out there growing interest in establishing common law courts. And I know that they're working hard. I'm not sure if there's, because they're up in New York, so I'm not sure if they actually have a common law court established in New York. Not that I've heard or not that I know of. But anyway, the point is that if you really want your justice back, where you're not actually going to be, you know, standing in front of, especially if you live in a corrupt state, and standing in front of a judge that doesn't care about your liberties and doesn't really care about the true rule of law and the real laws that they're supposed to be enforcing. So this is why this is critical for you to understand this. You need to determine whether you've got common law, and this is something that, you know, can help people get energized, as far as I'm concerned. If you really want justice back, you have to start driving petitions. Now, I would not start my petition on trying to establish common law courts. You need to start driving your petition against your representatives who are allowing the invasion to occur, not doing anything about the invasion, not doing anything about the placement of Islam in your, the placement of Islam in your community. Sorry about that. So when we look at many of the issues, we have petitions that you can literally plug and play. You just plug in your own county, state, that type of information, and it's ready to go. Then all you need to do is super add a small petition to point it towards very specific things that are akin to what that, like in the invasion, you've got a governor that is literally violating and doing things. You can point out those acts that he's doing and how he's literally violating his oath. And we can help you with those things. But that's how you get things going. Once you start really driving these petitions and letting everybody know, we're calling them all out for everything. There's two tactics. Let me just stop really quick, and forgive me for going down this aside, because some people want to hear this a little more upfront than they do, you know, at one point in time. So I'll just try to cover it this time, and I'll cover it again when I think it's been too long that I haven't said anything about this. So there's two tactics you can use. You can do the Martin Luther tactic with a compendious summation and walk into your county commissioners and literally, you know, filibuster them for weeks and weeks and weeks because there's that many atrocities. Now, that might break them free of saying, hold on, hold on, hold on. How much you got on that list? And you can say, I got this many. The problem with doing it up front is until you've actually created credentials with your county commissioners, they're not going to jump up and say, wow, you're so right on all of this stuff. In other words, they've got to put their toe in the water. They've got to actually look at your arguments of each of these petitions. They've got to look and, you know, verify, wow, you know, those documents really say that. Once they have, you know, once you've given them, you know, enough cases where they can't refute your petitions, you become E.F. Hutton. I like using that term because it's, maybe it's old school, but it stands for something. It means that you have a level of credibility that everybody listens. So when you do this one at a time, you know, you're kind of landing a punch. And in some cases, if you've got bad politicians, you're going to want to petition them for every single one because it's like a public beating. If you walk in with a compendious summation or, you know, a full list of all the atrocities, boy, you know, you've proven to everybody in this one point in time, you know, all of the bad things this person's done. But unless you go around to every event, and the best thing to do is to capture the details of all of these different violations. That's why hitting them over and over again over each individual issue gives you more opportunity to use a public relations campaign to prove that you've got politicians that do not deserve to be in office. Yes, if you go in with a compendious or your full comprehensive listing of all of the things with some basic details, you know, people can kind of look at that. But until they actually see the arguments of what they did and how that's a violation, it's just, you know, you're asking them to take your word for it, if you understand what I'm saying. This is why I believe establishing that rapport, establishing that, you know, wow, you know, that guy really knows what he's talking about. After four or five, when you use these petitions, they're not going to be able to refute these. So when they look at these and they go, huh, okay, and then they look at the next one and the next one, they go, you know, okay, I can't refute these things, so how many more do you have so we can just cut to the chase? And that's when you give them the table of tyranny. That's when you give them the comprehensive list. Or actually the initial list. Now keep in mind that these petitions are not something that the county commissioners are needing to deal with directly. In other words, this is not something we're asking them to take a hold of and literally parse and you know, take a lot of their time. This is why every single petition, we demand that they establish a constitutional compliance committee. Then they can turn these petitions over to these committees, as well as give the committee a charge that they need to start doing some very specific things in moving forward and completely understanding what is constitutional, what is the constitution, which ones, what constitutes the true constitution. There's a lot of little things out there that need to be finalized at your county level before you can move forward. But once you've got this committee, once they finally do that, now you're really starting to head in the right direction, because now you have a committee of citizens in your county that are helping get the word out what is constitutional, what isn't. This is why I say it's very important that we want to tie or create a symbiotic relationship with your county parties. If you've got libertarians, constitutionalists, or the Constitution Party and the Republican Party, I mean, I would really doubt that the Democrats would even care about the Constitution. They're actually attacking it and trying to destroy it. There may be blue-collar Democrats that when they hear about this, and they may go to the Democratic Party and say, we don't want anything to do with that, that may cause them to leave, finally leave, because it is finally out in the open. The dirty laundry has been exposed. They are out to destroy our liberties. And blue-collar Democrats do love their liberties. You know, a blue-collar Democrat is a guy that votes Democrat because of the union, because they're just trying to protect their job, trying to make sure that they get top dollar for, you know, working less, whatever. And I know that I'm insulting people. I don't mean to do that, but bottom line, they do care. They still believe in apple pie, baseball, hot dogs, 4th of July, that type of stuff. They're not like these hardcore Democrats that want to put a Stalin, you know, a statue of Stalin in your town square, where they have done that in Seattle. So, folks, I'm just trying to help you understand that going through and understanding all of these problems, and we're focused right now on the court. And we're showing you how the court, by Hamilton's hand, has become corrupted. So the only way we can actually restore your justice system is we have to start restoring the Republican form of government. That's when the Republican form of government will actually take back the control of government and actually put the judiciary back into the bottle. Because when you look at your state constitution, just like the U.S. Constitution, the legislature has the responsibility of regulating those courts. They have the responsibility of regulating and overseeing your executives. They have and they are your sovereigns of your state. And understanding that is really critical. So hopefully this makes more sense. So you understand why we're doing this, because we need you to understand that we do have a judiciary form of government. And we're showing you how Hamilton has started stitching these little things and creating these, I'll just say these, I don't know, bombastic's not a very good term, but I mean this intricate weaving of how he's taking, you know, a thread or a task like the establishment of district courts and so forth, and in ways he's opening them up to be able to do far more than what they should be doing. And we see how he has done this. Once this Constitution got ratified, with the Federalist Papers he started, and he started attacking when he was the Secretary of the Treasury, and then afterwards he continued. He just continued attacking us. So anyway, so Sean, did that help the kind of the overview of the petitions? And let me ask you this. Do you agree that the one punch and building a huge PR case, providing all the details of why these bums do not deserve to go back into office, is better than a comprehensive, you know, they've done all of these bad things? Do you agree, or do you think?
Well, I think if you go, I agree with your methodology, and the way I would describe it is if you go in just lambasting them for everything that they do wrong, they are not going to be able to respond to that, and it would just cause an adversarial relationship right off the bat.
Right. Yes.
They would see you as a threat because you're and the people who don't understand, and people are scared of change, especially wholesale change all at one time.
Right.
So, I mean, you have to be able to take it a step at a time and get people to understand, you know, where the source is.
Right. So, eventually, you know, if you actually help people understand all of these different issues at the depth of each of the issues, instead of just a comprehensive listing, what you would end up doing and can do is have a group of people show up, or making sure there's a group of people. And this is what the JBS did to me. They had this little sheet of paper for everybody with what they were supposed to say. Here's the question. Here's the challenge they wanted to give me. None of it had anything to do with, you know, any of the actual context of, you know, what I'm purporting, what I'm, you know, projecting. And in the very specific meaning of when they had these scripts, they didn't even address anything I said. They wanted to attack me on my book, which I didn't even talk about my book.
Right.
Okay.
The identity politics to break down your reputation, just like you were talking about the importance of credibility and reputation.
Right.
And that's the first thing they're going to attack when they can't respond to the legitimacy of your argument.
Sure.
You know,
right.
It's the same thing in all of these. Now they have these debates going on, and you can't debate with people who have no reasonable, rational foundation for their ideas or their ideology. So it just turns into a shouting match, or, you know, a personality contest.
Right. Okay. So as we move forward, because we've just got less than a minute, so we won't do 21 until we come back after the break. But folks, as you move forward, you need to start creating an administrator or somebody that manages what petitions are, and, you know, what campaigns you're attacking, what petitions you're driving, you know, how many signatures you need to have, signature drives. This requires community involvement. And the best thing about this is people start realizing that, one, they actually got something to do with their government. They actually have a responsibility. And then, two, this is how we educate them. Because when you're sitting there and you're, you know, having these petitions, getting signatures and so forth, you're really walking through people that don't know anything and giving them the petition, or giving them a high level of, hey, this is why we're doing this. This is what this petition does. And these are the details. And so they give them an abstract and they go, oh, you betcha, I want to sign that petition. And boom. And if they want to get into the details, you'll have a copy of it. So they go, oh, wow. This is really interesting. I didn't know these things. So anyway, We're going to go into break. When we come back, we'll finish the last paragraph of Federalist Paper number 81. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's go ahead and finish up 81 so we can get into 82. Thank you.
Can I say something?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Sure.
Go
ahead. Before we went to break.
Sure.
It just came to me as you were discussing that. And one of the things that you always talk about is talking to people about myopic solutions or myopic actions, mm-hmm. like the Second Amendment or abortion or this or that, when the Constitution and compliance to the Constitution would solve a plethora of these problems. I think that's important to get people to understand, especially when you're going in. If you can relate to someone's passion, like everybody has their priorities of, you know, abortion is the most important issue, indoctrination in the school is the most important, Second Amendment or whatever. If you can get people to unite on the Constitution and then go at their myopic passion, I hate to say myopic, that sounds negative, but their selective passion, then you can get a diverse group of people together that are all working toward the same solution, which is constitutional compliance. But then at the same time, they're bringing in the other people who have their singular prioritized issue that would also be solved by that. I think that's a good way for us to network out into and solve this problem of the divided energy
right
that we have for yeah. for the republic.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've tried to make these, you know, I've tried to broker or myopic organizations to get involved, to say, you know, hey, we would love to have a subject matter expert like you involved in this, because you're bringing to the table a level, because you've already got some credibility. You've been out there and you've been leading against this invasion, like CARE against the, you know, Islam in America. You know, there's all these different organizations out there that, hey, why don't you, you know, take this petition and help drive this, and you know, so that we're all going out and getting signatures and getting people educated and aware. And
yeah, and go ahead. One other part of it that I was thinking, and it relates straight to scripture, and that's what made me think of this, is the diversity of gifts from God and how each person plays a part. Everyone might not be a teacher or a pastor or, you know, back in the day, speaking in tongues or mm-hmm. having different gifts, but it's the same spirit.
Right.
And the Constitution is that spirit in this case and in this cause.
Yeah, excellent, excellent, excellent point on the gift of spirits and uniting people. The problem that I keep on running into is the money. Organizations that I deal with are funded by nameless people or other organizations that we don't know. You know, like some other shell name of a company or what have you, they're getting this funding from somebody. They're, you know, because those funders don't want you to know who they are, like Koch Brothers or what have you. And so they sign these charters. They create their organization with a charter So to be clear here, a charter is not a contract. A charter is where somebody who's coming and saying, I'm going to give you money because you're going to do these things. And if you fail to do these things, and you're not going to be able to do these things. So anything that you don't do that you're supposed to do, or things you do that you're not supposed to do, then they can take your funding and shut you down just like that. In other words, they own your soul when you sign a charter. There's a huge difference between creating a contract, because now, you know, the financier has some obligations to do this, this, and this, and then the person receiving it, you know, but they have equal standing. A charter is actually handled by, or the grantor of the charter is considered the sovereign in the relationship, which is why all of the colonies were established with charters by the monarch of Britain, so that he had full control. And actually, even though he said, I'm going to let you do these things, he always had the ability to change that. Now, there were some shenanigans, like Massachusetts was a shenanigan. If you're familiar with, you know, them coming across and not making it on time, and they're getting here so late, they said, because we didn't get here on time, that violates or breaks the charter, so we're going to make our own charter, which is exactly what they did. And so, you know, that, I'll say that right there, that independence is definitely an American spirit, because there have been plenty of charters created, or I should say states. There have been a few states. I know Idaho, Wyoming, and I think Michigan came into the Union without enabling acts. So I'd like to see a full list of how many states just, you know, pushed themselves in. And they did it because they surrendered those things that the federal government wanted. And so the federal government was kind of keeping them at bay. And so some of these states actually surrendered more than necessary just to make it, you know, an overwhelming, appealing, yeah, this is a double win for us, for the federal government to bring these states in as subjugate or subjects to them, or some level of subject to them. Whatever those declarations are in their constitution, what have you, like public lands and so forth. And so over time, you know, you can see the huge difference of, you know, a charter as well as a compact, as well as a contract and so forth. But let's get back to that. Are we done? Or you got any more questions or anything else?
Oh, no, but I was thinking more, I understand what you're saying about these organizations. What I'm thinking about is grassroots and the people in your community.
Yes.
Who have these different
and
different priorities and different gifts.
Right, and actually grassroots,
and yes, on their level,
yes,
and getting them to understand, and then some of them might understand that the Constitution protects, or the Constitution is being usurped in their specific, you know, myopic issue, but
yes,
they didn't understand how all of that overreach is what's caused these different overlapping issues that we have to deal with, and how their, like you said, expertise and their passion for that topic would help if they're united with other people on the same foundational solution of constitutional compliance.
Yes. Yeah, and so when you talk grassroots, a lot of people in the party get involved in myopic issues. But that doesn't mean that they're totally myopic. They just, they have a passion for this, like the Second Amendment, what have you. But because they're involved in the party, they do have a more, they're not, they're part of the organization as maybe, you know, a fan or a, you know, You join to get the news, however the organization works. Like the John Birch Society has membership. If for $100, you get their I think their, what is it, something review. And, you know, you get to attend meetings and you get to attend, you know, these special presentations, that type of stuff. There are perks that come with that $100 a year. And so, you know, if you're a member, that doesn't mean, you know, like if you're a member of the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers or whatever the myopic issue is, that doesn't mean that you're actually a holder and a, I'll call it a gate guard. You're not necessarily a gate guard to make sure you're only doing one thing. Usually the leadership and people that are a part of the organization specifically, in other words, they're getting paid, then they're gate guards. They want to make sure that nothing at their organizations or functions distracts or, you know, brings up or allows any wandering off of those things that they're supposed to be focused on. Because that's their money's dependent on that. So anyway, all right, well,
it's
good.
A mirror of what goes on the left, like with the teachers' union.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
I know when I was teaching, they, I wouldn't say coerced us, but their pitch is if they'll give you legal representation, and as a teacher in public schools with the litigious nature of society today, if something goes wrong in your classroom and you get sued, they could destroy your whole life. So
yes,
they offer you legal protection through their attorneys and whatever, and then the people at the top use your dues and your advocacy to enact their ideological agenda.
Right. Yes. So anyway, let's close out Federalist Paper number 41 with the paragraph 21, and we can jump into 82. Hey, thanks a lot.
21. The amount of the observations hitherto made on the authority of the Judicial Department is this, that it has been carefully restricted to those causes which are manifestly proper for the cognizance of the national judicature, that in the partition of this authority, a very small portion of original jurisdiction has been preserved to the Supreme Court, and the rest consigned to the subordinate tribunals, that the Supreme Court will possess an appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact in all the cases referred to them, both subject to any exceptions and regulations which may be thought advisable, that this appellate jurisdiction does in no case abolish the trial by jury, and that an ordinary degree of prudence and integrity in national councils will ensure us solid advantages from the establishment of the proposed judiciary without exposing us to any of the inconveniences which have been predicted from that source.
Okay, so in the ratification debates, they had to emphasize that the judiciary was tied, its jurisdiction was tied to those things arising under this Constitution. Not once has Hamilton pointed that out. He speaks very ambiguously. And when actually we look at this right here at the very beginning, the amount of observations hitherto made on the authority of the Judicial Department is this, that it has been carefully restricted to those causes which are manifestly proper for the cognizance of the national judicature. Now, my point is, he's not saying anything very specific, like it's tied to only those things arising under the Constitution. Because not saying that means that, well, they know what they're supposed to do, and we're going to trust them. In other words, you know, if we don't understand what the tight rules are to keep them in check, then we can't keep them in check. And he skims over those types of details, which to me, which is by design. Let's dive into number 82. And to the people of the state of New York, and oh, by the way, this is July 2nd. So this is well after Virginia has ratified. So now we've got 10 states that have ratified the Constitution. They're all, you know, there's been a huge celebration nationwide that the union is going to form under the Constitution. And there's only 3 states left out right now. New York, North Carolina, and Rhode Island. All eyes may be turned to New York. And as a matter of fact, by this point in time, I believe Hamilton had received the word that Virginia has has ratified. Now, let me pull up, because I want to compare his comments and make sure I have them. I do not have them. So I'm going to pull them up really quick. And the reason I want to do this, folks, is when we look at the frequency and the amount of time that Hamilton was involved in providing testimony. In other words, how many, because he did not speak very often. And so when I say that, I mean, if you look at, let me see here. I want to go up to here. When you look at how many times, there are all these different orations and speeches and so forth, how many times did Hamilton have an opportunity to get up there and actually speak? And so let me see here. Hamilton speeches in the debates right here. And so I actually have the dates when he really started. He spoke on the 17th, then the 21st. And let me see, once on the 17th and one, two, three times on the 21st. And then on the 23rd, two times. And then on the 24th, another time. And the 25th, another time. The 27th, another time. And on the 28th, another time. The 28th, he did one, two, three more times. And then on June 30th is when, and I think this is when he got the word, because by the 28th or so is probably when he got the word, because I think Virginia, and I have to look it up, but Virginia ratified late June. And so I think they were going to celebrate the ratification, but I believe that they really just decided to wait for the 4th of July celebration, because they celebrated that for the big celebration. So Madison and the word, whether the Madison sent it or not, it doesn't matter. Hamilton got the word. And all of a sudden, Hamilton's behavior changed. And we're going to find out at the very end, he was in the penalty box. He was kind of suspended because of his brawling, verbal brawling and breaking decorum. And we're actually going to read, and I'm only going to show you these things. We won't read all of it. But I want you to see, Hamilton at this point in time knew. He was calculating that Virginia ratified, the sentiments were, overwhelming that they would ratify as well. There were a lot of people that were, the leaders of stopping the ratification, I think, were completely insensitive, because Hamilton read it, and he read it right. And so he just started acting and behaving badly because it didn't matter at that point. And he didn't care. He felt that it was done. And that's why he was dancing around, literally just doing more theory and very little substance in his debate. So that we're going to go through that. And you're going to notice that all these things that he's been writing since the middle of June about the details of the court, we'll find out how many times he actually talks about the court and provides these details. And I'll bet you it'll be a big fat zero, because he didn't want anybody to know what he was doing. That this would come up and nobody down the road would ever make a compare and contrast between the ratification debates and the Federalist Papers. His calculations were spot on. At least they were able to get out from underneath the tight grasp of the Constitution and take us for a 200-plus year ride on transforming our republic into a judiciary form of republic, a form of government. So forgive me for the intrusion on the reading of Federalist Paper 82. I'm just setting the stage again. So go ahead with paragraph 2.
Paragraph 2, the erection of a new government, whatever care or wisdom may distinguish the work, cannot fail to originate questions of intricacy and nicety. And these may, in a particular manner, be expected to flow from the establishment of a constitution founded upon the total or partial incorporation of a number of distinct sovereignties. It is time only that can mature and perfect so compound a system, can liquidate the meaning of all the parts, and can adjust them to each other in a harmonious and consistent whole.
Now, let me ask you, as you've read a lot of this already, most of it, I think Tammy's read a little bit, you're reading, you know, how he speaks. Is he hitting anything specific and diving into details? Or, I mean, you see how he's kind of talks around stuff?
It sounds like he's telling on himself that he's biding time in hindsight, reading it.
Yes.
And knowing what occurred.
Yeah. Okay. But he does bring in some very cogent points of what he wants the judiciary to be able to do. And by putting him in there, he knows that they will pour those out and show everybody, look, we have this right of interpretation. This is just fundamental. Of course we can interpret the law. How dare you challenge us? Alexander Hamilton, our God, you know, clearly stated it right here.
And the omissions are glaring as well.
Yes, correct. Okay, so paragraph 3.
Such questions, accordingly, have risen upon the plan proposed by the convention, and particularly concerning the judiciary department. The principle of these respect situations to state courts in regard to those causes which are to be submitted to federal jurisdiction. Is this to be exclusive, or are those courts to possess a concurrent jurisdiction? If the latter, in what relation will they stand to the national tribunals? These are inquiries which we meet with in the mouths of men of sense, and which are certainly entitled to attention.
Okay, and let's find out what little attention he provides us. So keep going.
The principles established in a former paper teach us that the states will retain all pre-existing authorities, which may not be exclusively delegated to the federal head, and that this exclusive delegation can only exist in one of three cases: where an exclusive authority is, in express terms, granted to the union, or where a particular authority is granted to the union, and the exercise of a like authority is prohibited to the states, or where an authority is granted to the union with which a similar authority in the states would be utterly incompatible. Though these principles may not apply with the same force to the judiciary as to the legislative power, yet I am inclined to think that they are in the main, just with respect to the former as well as the latter. And under this impression, I shall lay it down as a rule that the state courts will retain their jurisdiction they have now, unless it appears to be taken away in one of the enumerated modes.
Okay, so did you notice what he didn't say regarding the federal powers? Let me read through this. It's the very first half of this. And he says, the principles established in a former paper teach us that the states will retain all pre-existing authorities, which may not be exclusively delegated to the federal government. In other words, it's not exclusively delegated to them. And that this exclusive delegation can only exist in one of three cases. The first case, where an exclusive authority is, in express terms, granted to the union, granted to the states. Exclusive, granted to the states. Or where the particular authority is granted to the union and the exercise of a likely authority is prohibited to the states. Or where the authority is granted to the union in which, with which a similar authority in the states would be utterly incompatible. Now notice he never said anything about exclusively granted to the federal government. In other words, he opened this door that things were exclusively laid out for the states, but not so for the federal government. If
they were, the union not refer to the federal government?
So no. So the authority is granted to the union. So technically, I look at when you say the union, that's the states.
But yeah, he speaks of both of them in the next phrase as separate things.
Oh, in the following part, though these principles may not apply to the same forces.
No, where a particular authority is granted to the union and the exercise of a like authority is prohibited to the states.
Okay, so he may be considering the union because the...
I understood it as the union is the federal government.
Yeah, so when the union is prohibited from doing things, there's actually restrictions upon the states. So when Madison spoke, and that may be a nuance that I completely missed, and fortunately it came out in this, because I don't think in the earlier ones, he didn't expound between the union and states and federal. But Madison looked at the general government as the general government. Sometimes he would call it the federal, because it was a specific government being formed to serve the union. The union being the states. And the union actually having authority. Where it was the authority of the states over, and that's why in the the Virginia and the Kentucky resolutions, he literally talked about the union being the states and holding the federal government accountable to those objects or, you know, powers not given, that they could only do these things explicitly. The point that I'm trying to make here is that Hamilton did not use the words exclusively delegated when it came to the federal government. And the ambiguity on what he was referring to the union. See, when a state joins the union, most people think that they're joining to the federal government, but they're not. And Madison clearly states that when a state joins the union, they're joining to the other states. And they have this like, you know, obligation as well as the like benefits of what the union brings them. You know, the ability to trade openly, all of these types of things that they all participate in, but they also have to suffer from the problems and the oppressions that could come from the federal government. So I get it. I see what you're saying as far as how he kind of did this without really specifying back and forth, which, again, is another way of clouding it even further, because the union... as I see it, and how he's describing this, because he says the federal head in the very beginning, which may not be exclusively delegated to the federal head. He's basically saying that things are delegated or delegated to the states, but the Constitution doesn't delegate anything to the states other than some roles and responsibilities. What it does do is it restricts the states from very specific things. And that's why, and that this exclusive delegation can only exist in one of three cases. I think that as I've kind of parsed through this, that he's made this cloudy enough to where I believe that down the road, the concept of implied powers, because he knows that the Federalist Papers are going to be used. These are going to be the focused documents. And he did not want to expose the idea of implied powers, but he also did not want to leave implied powers off of the table by not mentioning them. It becomes, well, the allowance comes from the courts to basically say, well, there are these implied powers, you know. And as a matter of fact, John Marshall did this in some of his landmark cases, where he basically said if the federal government determines it's necessary and proper, they have the authority to do that. In other words, an implied power, when the necessary and proper clause never provided any powers. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help, and we'll cover this next time. Thank you so much. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.